This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I'm very excited to introduce Alexandra Horowitz. Alexandra is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Inside of a Dog, and she teaches at Barnard College, where she runs the Dog Cognition Lab, which to me sounds really cool. In her new book, Being a Dog, Following the Dog into a World of Smell, she delves into the amazing world that is the dog's sense of smell. The book has already gone on to win rave reviews. Kirkus Reviews wrote, like a Mary Roach, but with a solid scientific background to her credit, Horowitz is a skilled investigative reporter who takes readers into unfamiliar worlds, shares her experiences there, asks probing questions, and makes those worlds come alive. I was really hoping she would be bringing like a ton of dogs with her tonight, but that's okay. So without further ado, please help me in welcoming Alexandra Horowitz to Politics and Prose.
I don't always have dogs with me, but I'm usually covered in a lot of dog hair. I don't know if that counts. Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back at Politics and Prose. I was here probably 2.5 years ago with my book on looking, and which didn't even have that many dogs in it. And maybe some of you came out then. It was really nice evening. And now we're back to dogs. Finnegan's is ebony black, moist and dappled, two cavernous base clefts at its front. It can be often found poking into pockets or packages. Upton's is cleft with a visible valley, the whole thing guarded by short whiskers standing at attention, and it is nearly gymnastic in the breeze. These are my dogs, Finnegan and Upton, and those are my dogs' noses. I've written a book mostly about their noses, actually. It's about all dogs' noses. And what they can do and how they do it, and what it might be like to be an olfactory creature, a creature of smell, a creature of the nose. And it's also by us at the other end of that leash, and our noses and what we do with our noses or not, and what we have the potential to do in trying to embody that olfactory world of the dog. In some ways, it's really just about the ordinary things that are right in front of us that we see but do not see, that we look at but never attend to, that all of my work is really about. That includes the dog, you know, ubiquitous creature in our beds, in our homes, at our feet, attending to us, usually like an anthropologist, but rarely so well attended by us. And it includes the nose, which, although we all have one on the front of our face, you know, leading our way into the world, is also rarely attended. And I'm going to suggest that if you try to imagine without looking now your partner's nose or your mother's nose or your child's nose, it's hard to invoke that image, to come up with what it looks like. It's kind of the stepchild of the face, the unloved stepchild of the face, where we love our eyes and we're obsessed with putting things in our mouth, but the nose is kind of forgotten. So those are the things I like to focus on, the things that are overlooked, but in front of us. So you might wonder, it's right if you wonder how it happens that I've written a book about dog noses. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about how I got there in case this is you just unhappily wandered into the store and saw a dog on the cover and thought this is going to be great, and now it turns out it's about noses. I haven't always been interested in noses. In fact, I've always been uninterested in noses and pretty uninterested in smelling as well until the last couple of years. But there was this happy circumstance that draws a line through my life and to this point, and it starts with being an owner of dogs for my whole life, living with Heidi and Aster as a child, knowing a dog named Pumpernickel, for whom I really wrote Inside of a Dog, you know, to commemorate her and to kind of in gratitude for her. And with Pumpernickel, I wound up in graduate school studying non-human animal cognition, and I was really interested in, boy, how do you find out about the mind of an animal who can't respond to your questions, like, what's it like to be you? And they say nothing. And I got interested in looking at behavior that might allow us to make some inference to mind. It took about 6 months of going out the door 3 times a day with my dog, Pumpernickel, to watch her play in the park before I realized, you know, I should study dogs. That play is a really interesting behavior, and I might be able to make some theories about their cognition. And that's what I wound up doing, intensively studying not my dog, but dogs at play. I wound up then much more interested in dogs than just the general subject of non-human animal cognition. And I founded the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard, and I've been studying dogs since then. And when I wrote Inside of a Dog, I was representing what the state of dog cognition research, and now that's a real phrase that we can say and people's jaws don't drop, but that's a field that's been around for the last 2 decades. I was representing that field, but also I got very interested in this idea of the umwelt of the dog, what it might be like to be a dog, the dog's perspective, the soap bubble of what's relevant in the world, what they can perceive in the world, you know, that we all carry around with us. And for an olfactory creature, the umwelt must be entirely about a smell world. And so this book, I took a real deep dive into smell. It's about, as I say, our noses and dogs' noses. So I thought I'd start with the capacity of the dog nose. Scientific measures of the sensitivity of the dog's nose are limited more by the capacity of measuring devices and dogs' interest in submitting to them than by their noses. Both pet dogs and tracking dogs have been put through their paces in a variety of threshold detection tasks that ask how diluted an odorant can be before a dog stops noticing that it's there. Pick out a canister with the smell of banana, amyl acetate, from a series of non-banana-smelling canisters, for instance. Dogs keep finding the banana until it is diluted to 1 to 2 parts per trillion. A couple drops amyl acetate, 1 trillion drops of water. Early research with one very cooperative fox terrier concluded that she could essentially detect 1 milligram of butyric acid, think smelly socks, among 100 million cubic meters of air. You'll notice your spouse's smelly socks the moment after they're removed in the bedroom. That's around 40 cubic meters of very socky smelling air. The dog knows if someone's removed his socks in a room bigger than the gargantuan vehicle assembly building at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida, made to put the space shuttles together. Any dog in the nearly 4 million cubic meters of Space Center would be alert to sweaty astronauts. Explosives detection dogs smell as little as a picogram, a trillionth of a gram of TNT or other explosive. What might it be like to notice a picogram of an odor? Since explosives dogs come to have very fond associations with their search odors, let's think of an aroma pleasing to our noses, cinnamon rolls cooking in a home kitchen. The average cinnamon roll has about a gram of cinnamon in it. Sure, the human nose is on it from the moment we open the door of the house. Now imagine the smell of 1 trillion cinnamon rolls. That's what the dog coming in with us smells when we enter. So I resolved to find out more about this. I studied the dog myself at our dog cognition lab. I put them through olfactory trials, pet dogs usually seeing what they can distinguish by smell, seeing if they know themselves and others by smell. I talked to researchers in olfaction and in fluid dynamics who are studying the airflow, literally, they study this, of the nose and have modeled the airflow of the dog's nose and revealed such amazing facts as how the dog sniff, the extraordinary sniff of the dog. You might not think that there's more than one way to sniff. Maybe you've never thought that in your life, but you should because our way isn't that good. For one thing, we sniff rarely. Most of smells just have to try to waft in, but don't make it up to the little tissue of cells up here, which is where our smell receptor, olfactory receptor cells are. You have to seriously sniff in to mostly smell. Our sniff is about, if we just all sniff, can we just all sniff right now? It takes about 1.5 seconds to do that. So a dog is sniffing about 5 to 10 times a second. So that many more odor pictures of the world every second. But there's more, even better. They exhale better than we do. So we exhale through our nose if you want to get a smell out, right? It's a horrible smell. You want to rid your nose of it. You exhale through your nose. Well, but dogs don't want to get rid of the smell in their nose. Like, that is their world. You know, as we wake up and look at the room, we see the world. Dogs wake up and smell the room in front of them. So they don't want to constantly be blinking it out. So instead of exhaling directly through the indoor, through the nostrils, they exhale through the side slits of their nose, out the side. And in fact, if you're close, if you see a dog sniffing close to the ground, you might notice a little puff of air that comes up, you know, stirring dirt or substance on the ground. That's from those turbulent air jets that come out of their side slits of their nose. And wondrously, it helps hurry more odorous molecules in. So they can almost get a continuous odor vista of the world. I followed detection dogs. I followed truffle detection dogs outside of Seattle. We have truffles in this country. And we don't have pigs rooting for them. We have dog handler teams looking for them. And you, with experiences like this, you walk into a forest. It looks like a forest. And 3 seconds later, a dog has found truffles under a tree. They're pretty impressive. And I also watched detection dogs being trained, or actually these are dogs who will become detection dogs. They're just in the very early parts of their life, bred by and raised by people at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center under Dr. Cindy Otto. So I thought I'd read a little bit of what they're doing there. I'm crouched under a desk in a back room in an old DuPont chemical building. The building is giant, 3 stories of impossibly long hallways and once bustling laboratories. It's now abandoned. The room I am in had been an office, perhaps, for one of the researchers who worked in the adjoining lab. Stripped wires hang from the ceiling of the lab. Chemical hoods and faucets collect filmy dust. Everything about the room is decrepit. Stained carpets underfoot, stained and broken ceiling tiles overhead, stained and broken leveler blinds half-mast over casement windows on the walls, unopenable from the inside. The entire building is basement cold, the halls bare. Though lights flicker on here and there, every room down the long hallway is unkempt, as if the building had not only been cleaned out, it had been cleaned out in a hurry. Bookends are scattered near shelves, drawers are left half open and half empty. I look on the floor around me. A scattering of small washers peers up at me, yelling, "Oh," silently. When the door closed behind me, it did not feel good. The room is an insulated chamber. I feel a bit as though I will need to be rescued. I hear a trainer's muffled yell, "Dog on sight," downstairs. And then I wait, hand-gloved and clinging onto a leather tug toy. "Gus on sight," the trainer shouts. Gus is a yellow Labrador retriever with a taut body and velvet ears. I sit in silence 3 stories in a long hallway from where he would have entered the building. Then, suddenly, I hear him charging through the halls. I can almost see the muscular body of a dog through his galloping vibrations in the floors. I think of suspects being pursued by a police dog. I get a glimmer of their nervousness. When the dog closes in, when that strong, determined animal approaches, I experience a little of what it might be like to be the destined prey of a skilled predator. He thunders into the next room. I can hear his breathy panting and sniffing. My predator, come savior, barks twice, then stops. Then 2 more barks. Rummaging sounds come from his side of the door. I place myself fully by the door, ready to open it, tug toy in hand. More barks. 3, 4. At 8 barks, I open the door and we encounter each other. At the sight of me, his eyes seem to widen. He shifts suddenly back. I thrust the toy into Gus's mouth, as I've been directed to do. He takes it, half playbows, half barks, and tugs with force and pleasure. He's found me. So this is the kind of activity that happens if you go to the Penn Vet Working Dog Center and volunteer to be a lost person in an abandoned building. This is how they train dogs to find you. They don't let them smell you or give you a piece of your clothing to find you. They just know there is somebody in the building and you should find that somebody. And so in the training, you hold a tug toy, and when the dog finds you and alerts, and in this case they were training an 8-bark alert that gives the handler, who's way behind the dog at this point, enough time to catch up to the dog and find the missing person who's been found, they get a game of tug. That is the reason detection dogs do what they do, for a game of tug. Not because they care particularly, necessarily, about the people they're finding, or the explosives, or the drugs, or the illegally imported guava, or electronics that they're trained to find, but because they get a game of ball or a tug at the end. So in training, you give them ever more difficult hides, and I was the hide, and at the end of each one, you reward them for finding the person. What I found watching these dogs is that none of them is trained to smell. They're not. It's no smell training at all, as a matter of fact. They already know how to smell where the hidden person is, where the cadaver is, where the drugs are, cancer, lowering blood sugar, as they do in diabetic alert. They smell it already. They have to be trained to tell you when they find it, to tell you when they have found the one thing that you've said is important to you. And then when they tell you by alerting, they get rewarded. And that's the practice. So I want to read a little bit about one dog going through this practice. I mean, in many ways, I like to think of them as kind of anti-pets. Because they're really high drive dogs. That's the main feature of these dogs, not dogs that have tested at having amazing noses. It's assumed they have amazing noses. What they have to have is real motivation to continue to search and search and search to get that smell, knowing that at the end of it, there'll be a reward. So they are really anti-pets. They also teach them to bark constantly when they find the thing, which we don't want to do, or to bite if they're potentially a police dog, which we don't want them to do. And they won't give up, right? They won't give up until they've found the thing, which is exactly what you don't want your dog to do. You want your dog to give up in their search for the whatever the thing is that they're trying to find under your couch or in your bed. Okay, so... this is from my second day visiting at Penn. Second day, find dope. I follow Bob Doherty into another smaller DuPont building. Doherty is an active canine handler and comes to the center on his days off from being a police officer. He wears serious work shoes in an easy manner. His comfort around dogs is apparent. Papa Bear, a full, strong chocolate lab, is by his side. Today, he will be initiated into the world of narcotics. Papa Bear is being trained to sniff out drugs. He has been a generalist thus far, and Doherty is tasked with trying to get him to be more of a specialist so that he can be usefully placed with a permanent handler. Up a set of worn stairs, through a dizzying set of doors and small anterooms, we arrive in a big double-sized room with a chem lab kitchenette along one side. The room has a huge multicolored sunburst on the floor, some late-night paint test accident. Doherty takes out a large plastic bag and pulls out a towel. It had been cavorting overnight with a smaller plastic bag containing a small amount of the scent source. Quantity matters. A dog trained on a subtle scent may not know to alert if he has discovered a large amount of the scent. It's almost a different stimulus. On the other hand, starting with too large an amount of the scent in the room is too much. If I put 2 pounds of marijuana in here, Doherty explains, the odor will be all over the place. A dog just learning won't be able to localize it. Even so, I can easily smell the presence of groggy, giggling teenagers in the park as the bag is opened. We can all smell it, surely. The task being presented to Papa Bear, though, is to learn that this sweet smell, more or less, stronger or weaker, is the smell he needs to find in order to get a partner for a vigorous game of tug. Without being able to explain this to Papa Bear, Doherty simply works backward from the desired result. He begins with a vigorous game of tug with the towel rolled on itself and secured with rubber bands, smelling of pot. Papa Bear mouths the towel intensely, his strong tail slicing the air. Then Doherty tosses the towel. Papa Bear readily pursues it, bringing it back to him for another tug. After this, Doherty begins to feign toss the towel, making Papa Bear work to find the source. The dog is thrilled, breathing heavily with excitement and effort. But when he begins to search, he closes his mouth until it is barely ajar. Dogs have to have their mouths mostly closed to smell. his head cocked in contemplation. Already something has happened. The dog is going to get the odor and bringing it to his handler, the start of narcotic search. Papa Bear looks to be getting the game, and Doherty starts ramping up the difficulty level. Within minutes, he hides the towel in plain sight, then out of sight, then hides the bag alone. Find dope, he instructs, introducing new vocabulary to match the new game. Papa Bear finds the target at each step, without a hiccup. He's now finding dope. It's been about 45 minutes since he walked up the building stairs to this room, never having smelled the stuff before. And that's a very typical kind of training session for the dogs. So then the other part of this book, once I followed a lot of dogs doing a lot of nose work, was paying attention to our own nose. I talked to a lot of olfactory researchers, human olfactory researchers, and they all said some version of the same thing, which is, you know, dogs' noses get all the press, but our noses are pretty good. Our noses are quite good. And lest you not believe that, I mean, what have you smelled today? I mean, have you smelled many things today? Like more than one thing, maybe? There is a good good proof of the power of our smell, which is food. Did you taste your food today? Did it have any flavor? Because taste is mostly smell. Certainly we have taste receptors that give us the sense of sweet or sour or bitter. But the flavor of the food, the enjoyment of the food, comes from the fact that in chewing food, we warm it up, we make it smaller, it vaporizes and goes up the back of our nose, back of the mouth, through the back of the nose to those same cells. It's called retronasal olfaction. This is why when you have a cold and your nose is congested, you might not have that much flavor in your food. Or if you put an orange in your mouth with your nose plugged and you start chewing, there's no orange there. There might be texture, there might be sweetness or sour, but there's no orange until you unplug your nose. Try it at home. But I wasn't entirely convinced. For instance, I smelled very little and I knew my dogs were smelling quite a bit. So I decided to try to train my own nose. And I'll read at last my first attempt at this. I figured I'll just follow the dogs. The dogs are smelling. I'll just see what they show me. It occurred to me that should I truly want to grasp the dog's sensory experience, it might make sense to begin with the dog's walk. I'm already along for the ride. As dog owners, we are implicit, if rather uninformed, accomplices as our dogs sniff their way down sidewalks, along road edges and park paths. How much more might it take to convincingly experience what they smell? After all, everyone who walks a dog surely sees, after a few goes around the block, the dog's heightened interest in fire plugs, a tree branch fallen overnight, or a building scaffold newly erected. Over many, many walks, I began to get better at predicting what would be of interest to my various dogs, following their noses. That fence post looks recently moistened, I found myself thinking. Or, oh, that leaf pile looks pretty appealing. This is, of course, but a tiny minority of the dog's smelling experience. Everything they seem to put their eyes to, they are nosing. The passers-by, the wash of air from a car door opening, the ground around the park bench, the plastic bag being swelled up by a breeze, or the helicoptering maple seed being sent down by the trees. I see it, but do I dare to smell it? Do you ever smell what the dog is smelling? Avery Gilbert, an olfactory researcher, first says when I ask him for a suggestion on how to become better at using my nose. You want to get as close to the ground as you can to smell things, Stuart Firestein, another researcher, tells me, because that's where the molecules are. While I know this logically, I had not followed it through to, as Gilbert tells me, get down there and sniff at it. Indeed, we don't generally sniff it, whatever it is. And so I determined to sniff at it, to smell my neighborhood as my dogs did. I found myself surprisingly unworried about the obvious, that the reason we don't sniff what dogs are sniffing is essentially simple self-preservation and survival. There are funky, foul, downright fetid smells on the sidewalk. Our species may be the robust, successful species it is because we do not ingest the non-ingestibles down there. Instead, I considered the logistics. How could I get at the smells? To start, I figured I must be willing to lose some of my restricting bipedal configuration. If indeed being upright, nose too far from the ground, is what keeps us from smelling, why, I'd go on all fours. When my dog lingers with nose planted at the base of a tree, so shall I plant my nose. If he gets intimate with a patch of invisible interest in the grass, so shall I pursue that interest. If he makes inquiries about the pant cuff of a passerby, so shall I. Passerby willing. I began strongly. On a cool summer morning, Finnegan Upton and I launched out off the stairs in front of our apartment building. Right away, Finn angled for a tree guard, the impotent short iron fences that ring street trees in New York City. He examined the edge, which looked recently moistened, with the precision of a watchmaker diagnosing the innards of an ill watch. When he came up for air, I took over. I had to kneel awkwardly, one hand ringed with leashes and the other on the rail. I bent very, very close, too close. Emboldened by Finn's thorough vetting of the spot, I sniffed with abandon. A strong, bright smell hit me. I sniffed again. It was not urine, I thought with appreciation. It was simply the cool astringency of paint on metal. As I pulled back my head, my dog stood to the side, watching me. A couple walking up the hill took a wide berth. I got up, suddenly self-conscious, brushed off my knees, and let Finn pull me away and down the sidewalk. So I found that I wasn't quite up to that yet. It's socially awkward to smell. We don't smell things. We don't stick our noses in things. And so I got some conspirators to help me along the way. I did a walk with a woman named Kate McLean, who is an urban designer interested in mapping the smells of cities. And she does smell walks where a bunch of colleagues and she walk around first awkwardly and then with more confidence and then with huge confidence sticking our noses in things and recording what we smelled. I talked to noses, expert noses, and there are plenty of them. These are not people who are born with incredible noses, but who've spent a lot of time practicing smelling things for their art, perfumery, sommeliers. I followed an animal tracker who uses their nose to find animals, not just visual track of animals in the forest, but also olfactory track. I'm very proud, maybe too proud, that I was able to identify a porcupine by the smell of his pee. It's very piney. Okay, I think I'm gonna stop there and maybe take some questions. My nose did get a lot better. I do wanna say, kind of in conclusion, that the great pleasure in having spent the last years thinking about smelling is that my world has changed. It's changed color. It now smells. You know, maybe it always smelled, but there's a huge difference between letting smells happen to us, as we usually do, and feeling this is a great smell or horrible smell or and never the twain shall meet, or living more like a dog, which is seeing that everything we can see, all the objects in this room, each of us has an odor. It's information about us. It's another sensory dimension that we've ignored, and all we have to do is stick our noses out and sniff at it. Thank you.
I believe many of us have been in a car with a dog. The window comes down a little bit, and the dog sticks his or her head out there.
Absolutely.
I'm just wondering whether this is a situation where they enjoy the fact that the rush of air is a supercharger with smells in it, or there's something entirely different.
My guess is that it's like olfactory fireworks for them, basically. I mean, smells come on the breeze, so they need to be lifted into the air if you're an air-scenting dog to be caught by a nose. And so you stick your nose out into a big breeze. It's just a huge wash of odors one after the other. So although it's probably not safe for a dog to be, you know, riding with their head out the window, like a nose out the window, I always encourage.
I was wondering if you learned about differences in different breeds of dogs, like pugs and bulldogs have like shorter snouts, and so they're known to have like breathing problems and things like that, and whether you noticed their tracking or smelling ability was different than other dogs.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, and I like to say that we don't see a lot of pug explosive detection dogs, and there's a good reason for that in the airports. There are traditionally scent hounds, bloodhounds, bassets, and so forth, who are considered the best smellers, and in fact, they have many more of those olfactory receptor cells in their nose. So we have probably about 6 million. I keep pointing here because this is where it is. Because I always, you know, we think of the nose like the whole thing is doing something, but this is not lined with cells. You know, this is just the conduit that gets air up to the sensory cells. So we have about 6 million. Most dogs have hundreds of millions more than that. And the bloodhounds and bassets and so forth have hundreds of millions more still. Then also, detection dogs are usually from certain lines. So you see German shepherds and Dutch shepherds and retrievers are typically the ones bred. But interestingly, there was a researcher I talked to in Seattle, Sam Wasser, who runs a program called Conservation Canines, where he uses mixed breed dogs, exclusively mixed breed dogs, and exclusively mixed breed dogs from shelters who are high drive, kind of borderline obsessive dogs who can't be placed, but who turn out to be terrific at doing whatever it takes to find the scent, which in his case is scat, the excreta of animals he wants to track in order to get a ball. So he uses mixed breed dogs and they do fabulously. There's been some research showing that just if everybody's untrained, comparing scent dogs from long-nosed dogs like the retriever or the average mixed breed to short-nosed dogs, the scent hounds do best at detection, and then the long-nosed dogs, and then the short-nosed dogs, they do less well. And certainly it is partially because they have trouble getting air up their nose, right? Then we did that to dogs. You know, we flattened their faces and gave them the short little nose, and the result of that is they're not as good at smelling. If they can get air up there, they still have, you know, many olfactory receptors and can do scent detection. But they probably aren't going to be hired by the TSA.
Hi. Could you say a little bit about dogs versus other animals and kind of how their senses of smell compare? And and why is it that dogs in particular evolve so much kind of to be smell focused versus other things?
You know, there are a lot of olfactory creatures. You know, any animal whose nose is really close to the ground probably has a great sense of smell. At some point in, you know, human history, when we were closer to the ground, we probably had a better sense of smell. And one of the theories of why we're not great at olfaction is that, you know, we stood up and our noses were in the air and vision came to the fore, binocular vision, and we became less focused on olfaction. One theory. Freud thinks that, you know, when we stood up is when civilization began, and, you know, to smell is to end civilization. But putting that aside, there are many other really great olfactory creatures. You know, elephants are terrific. Rodents, many types of rodents are also terrific. You know, even cats. I have to say, even cats have good sense of smell. They don't have a great snout, particularly, but perfectly good sense of smell. So the reason we focus on dogs so much is basically two things. One, they're in our world, in our life, in our beds and couches and at our feet, but live in a kind of sensory parallel universe to us. So it's this very different creature who we think of as ordinary, but it turns out that they do have this different life. And also they are the ones doing the detection tasks because they're so tractable, because they're so happy to work with us and so cooperative to the premise of being asked to find something and tell us, you know, for a ball. Whereas most other olfactory animals are not as interested. Although I do know there's some work looking at sending rats to do landmine detection, right? And they can do that. And probably the soldiers who are handling the rats, they might not form the bond that they'll form with their dogs they're sending out to detect the landmine and potentially end their life. Although, I don't know, maybe we'll be here in 10 years talking about the rat-soldier partnerships and the bond. Yeah.
Is it correct that the Basset Hound and the Bloodhound aid their smell? They're so good at it because their ears are long and flap as they move their heads back and forth, and the flapping ears stir up the molecules.
That is correct. Yes. Exactly right. I couldn't have said it better.
I assume dogs, since they're mammals, can have colds and other problems that humans have with their noses. Do we know that this affects their sense of smelling?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I haven't ever heard of detection dogs being pulled because they have a cold. And it could just be that the tissue would need to be really inflamed to so close up the root that it would diminish their performance. One interesting feature of olfaction, sometimes I get asked if dogs lose their sense of smell as they might lose eyesight or hearing as they age, and it seems less likely, actually, because olfactory cells have this interesting property that they regenerate every month or so. That's the case in us as well, in our noses as well. So they're being enlivened all the time, unlike, say, the hair cells in the ear, which are literally being mowed down with the noise of current civilization, right? If you're over 20, you can't hear those high-frequency sounds that people under 20 do because you lost the hair cells and they're not growing back. So in some ways, age, if considered potentially a deficit for detection dogs, might not be because they keep getting new olfactory cells. Yes?
Yes, can I ask a question about the use of smell in training of dogs in general? And what provokes my question is we're training a six-month-old puppy now, and we've done dog training before, but there's a new exercise they have us doing, holding kibble in the left hand as a reward or just a treat, and then putting our right hand out with smells on it. It can be just the smell from the debris of the kibble, or it could be a piece of chicken or whatever. And then you tell the dog to touch, and they learn to touch their nose to the right hand, then you immediately give them the treat in your left hand.
Right.
And it's a way of getting their attention or stopping them from doing
yes.
something else that they might be doing. I hadn't seen this before in all the dogs I've owned over the years.
Yeah, well, so this is a marker a lot of people like to use, getting their dogs to touch as a way of getting them to be attentive to the person.
Right.
And so having the like just slight bit of chicken or kibble smell on your hand is the reward, is the incentive without them being able to eat anything, okay. right? So that's why then you rush in with the other hand to give them the reward. But, you know, just that little bit of debris is perfectly attractive to them, but then they're restricted from eating. And so I think that's why it's used. It's just a pairing it's an association, basically, because they'll go to the smell, and then they've done the thing which you call mark, you know?
Okay.
And so then they realize that it's touch the hand, and so then you can just put out your hand without the smell, and they'll know to do that, and their attention will be on you. So that's
the
good.
The smell is almost like in a hierarchy of rewards, it seems.
The smell itself, in that case, isn't serving as the reward, but you could use a smell as a reward, almost. Yeah, that's
real.
We just use really blunt, big rewards usually, like huge amounts of food, right? Mm. But they don't need that big reward as they get better trained.
I see. Thank you.
Good luck with your dog.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a very short question, but this conversation prompts one ahead of it. If one hand has kibble in it, would seem to me it would smell much more strongly than the one that just has something else making it smell.
Yeah.
So how do you prevent them from heading for the strongest smell?
Right, I mean, if you're not doing a training, then they'll try to.
I didn't get that.
They'll go for the one.
Okay.
But you can encourage, you can block it.
And then my other question is, you mentioned elephants having a good sense of smell after you spoke of the optimum nose length for smelling in dogs. And elephants have a very long nose mm-hmm. for that scent mm-hmm. to travel in. So how does that work?
Well, I'm not sure that their trunk is entirely filled with the turbinate bones, these bones that are inside the nose of a dog that help do all the great things that they do, which is they help... they have cells which help humidify and clean and warm the air that comes in so that it's ready to be received by the sensory cells. So if you look at a cross-section that has been reconstructed from imaging of the dog nose, it looks like the cross-section of a human brain. It's just huge curlicue turbinate bones, all these bones. And we have three bones that do that in our nose inside. I doubt that the elephant nose has that all the way through, although I'm sorry to say, an expert on elephant noses. My guess is most of it is not covered with those bones and that tissue. But they do have quite acute sense of smell. I mean, and they just use their nose for three other things at the same time, so we don't tend to focus on their smell.
Of course, they can select from a wider range, I guess, with that nose reaching.
Well, they have a longer reach, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
You sure?
Can I just add
yeah.
the other way they teach us in training to your question? You keep your hand shut with the kibble in it, and there's no way the dog can get it. So eventually it learns to go to the smell first. Yeah. But they go for that food. They know you won't let go.
All training is just giving them the opportunity to do the thing that you want to reward, and then when they do it, you reward it. Right. So if your hand is there and they touch it, you're like, oh, that's the reward. And they learn pretty quickly. Oh, that was the thing. It was touching the hand. That was the thing that got me that fistful of kibble.
Seeking some advice for good care, being a good care person for your dog in an apartment or a house.
Yeah.
Are there some smells that are bad, dangerous or hurtful to the dog that we would not be aware of and they can't tell us?
Yeah.
Can you give us some advice on what those might be that we wouldn't otherwise know?
Any smell. Yeah, I'm not sure that there are. A very intense smell has the potential to be alarming. I'm not sure if toxic to a dog. The dog will tell you that. You know, you don't have to wonder about it because the dog will move away just as we move away from a smell that might be toxic to us. I think there are definitely smells dogs do not. I mean, and few smells that dogs do not prefer. And they are mostly smells that we think are clean smells, right? So the dog being bathed in the like lavender, beautiful lavender shampoo and so forth. Like, what does that dog do next? Like, go out and like, I smell so great. I smell so great. They roll in something because they're trying to get that smell off. And so I'm not sure that's not toxic per se, but it covers the smell of themselves, which is an important signal socially to other dogs and potentially to themselves. You know, they are even smelling themselves. So smells like that and a lot of cleaning smells that we use are noxious to a dog. Isopropyl alcohol and things, you know, things that are in cleaners are noxious to the dog, but I'm not sure that they're toxic. They're just things the dog doesn't prefer.
A difficult question, uncomfortable question. When the dogs are smelling each other,
yes.
What in the world are they getting? What's the information that they're getting?
I can't believe it took this long for that question.
Mine goes back and back. Like, I didn't get enough.
Yeah.
I need more information.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's very embarrassing. So what is he doing?
I know, it's so embarrassing to us. It's so rude, right? Like, I haven't sniffed your rump at all. And I feel like we're cool with that. But for dog, it is not impolite. And furthermore, a lot of people say, like, listen, they can smell. If they can smell so well, why can't they do it at a distance? Why don't they have to get in there? Right. But I feel like that in some ways we're entirely mistaking what it might be like to be a great smeller. Based on our own perspective, which is to say, we're interested in maybe detecting the smell, but they're not trying to detect, is there a dog there? Like, they know there is. They're trying to get the full measure of the smell. The type of information that a dog could get by sniffing the rump of another dog includes the identity information. In other words, dogs have a signature smell. We all have a signature smell. Your dog knows it, will recognize it, will know if there's something wrong with it. You know, this is how the beginning of cancer detection dogs was, that there were dogs who noticed the smell of melanoma on people and kept smelling it. You know, if you have a dental infection or a lung infection, your dog will be interested in the smell of your mouth because they smell that. So that's noticing the smell of disease as contrasted to your normal smell. Dogs have a signature smell. Other dogs are trying to smell it. It's their health, as with us. It's potentially what they've eaten. It's their sex also. You know, dogs never like peeking under the other dog to see if it's a male or a female. They smell it. They smell male or female. So there are all sorts of features about that dog and that dog's history which could be smelled by. These are, you know, from the glands around in the rump area and on the tail and from the anal sacs. All that has information. Interestingly, there was research recently that showed that female and male dogs have slightly different approaches when meeting a new dog. So female dogs more often will greet a new dog by sniffing the face closely. And there are glands around the eyes and in the ears, around the nose, sweat glands that will have some of this information. And male dogs, by contrast, are more likely to go to the rump first. But that tells us one thing about what they might be doing, which is there's reproductive information in the rump area that a male dog might be interested in. And so there's that as well. Is this dog ready to mate? So all that information is there. I let them sniff. It's not impolite.
Just related to that, I was in someone's home after I had injured my leg, and a dog I'd never met before came over and licked my leg, and you know, he just came directly to me.
Yeah, injury has a smell.
The question I came up with was regarding: is there any way for us to appreciate the difference that are a few million of receptors, what we get as opposed to hundreds of millions? Is there any way to grasp what a dog, how grand that experience is? But since I've been up here.
It's in this. It's okay, sort of in good. There. Good. But I will give it a shot.
Well, that's okay. But because a more specific question, when you mentioned about rolling to get rid of the smell,
yeah.
I think most of us have seen dogs roll on a dead animal.
Yes.
And they practically look like they're grinning
yes.
when they do it. I mean, they
sure.
are.
Oh yeah,
it's
great.
Heaven.
So, okay,
but why a dead? I mean, why is that smell?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So two questions. So how could we kind of get a sense of what it's like? Well, so imagine, like, how many things you've smelled. The difference between our smell and their smell might be the difference between how many things you've smelled in this bookstore since you came in, and how many things you've seen. Like, there is an olfactory world, and ours is not. second, the rolling in things question. So this is something scientists haven't, you know, perfectly answered, although it's a legitimate question. Like, why do dogs roll in especially dead or foul things or fecal things? And there are two kinds of theories about it. One is a camouflage theory, and this comes from the fact that in the wild, animals like other canids, like wolves, might roll in something to kind of camouflage their own scent. So for instance, if you were a wolf going into another wolf's territory, you might not want to smell like yourself because you are an outsider. You might want to smell like, you know, the whatever is dead that's been lying around in that home territory. So it's a camouflage. Probably less likely with dogs, where territories are not an issue. Dogs are not territorial. In the same way at all. That's the wrong language to put on their behavior. The other theory that I think is probably more likely is the kind of popularity theory. So dogs love strong smelling and new things. Strong smelling things and new things. There it is. The squirrel just died. It's starting to decay. It's starting to smell. That's fantastically rich for them. You know, they're not making an evaluation like we make about that being a really bad smell or a really great smell. It's just full of information. And so just like us, when we have a really nice scent, like we're like, I'm going to just put some here and here. Like they just roll right in it. Then perhaps it makes them a more popular, interesting creature because they're wearing that wonderful scent. So that's a theory yet to be definitively tested.
Okay.
Maybe two more. Yes.
I've noticed, I live in an apartment, and when other people walk by my apartment, like, they can get out of their car and walk by, and the dog doesn't react.
Uh-huh.
But if I walk out of my car, probably, I don't know, 50 yards or whatever from my apartment, before I even get to the building, he's already barking knowing I'm coming home.
Yeah.
Or he already has a reaction knowing I'm getting there.
Yeah.
And is it because he can smell that far?
Well, certainly that there's potential that he could smell that far. So there are a lot of things that could go into that phenomenon, and we would need to study your behavior for quite a while to really know. But for instance, if you are habitually arriving home at a similar time of day, okay, different times of day, okay, and your car also has a distinctive sound, presumably compared to other sounds. If you're a dog who's sitting at home and has nothing to do, nothing is happening, there's nothing going on, you're not reading any books, you're not watching TV, you're doing nothing but listening for when you come home. So potentially that sound is really salient. But also smell, I think, is relevant. I think it's less likely that the dogs who are knowing when their owners are coming home are smelling them coming, although it's possible. You'd need air flow through the windows, for instance, to be able to smell you coming. I think it's more likely that what dogs who do that are sensing is that your smell is in the house. Like, our houses smell like us. But as we're gone, the longer we're gone, the less the house smells like us. So at a certain time, they start to anticipate that we should be arriving home, because our smell has diminished a certain amount. This is a dog who lives with you for a while, not a dog you meet this week. They're not going to start doing this. But a dog who sort of knows your habits and knows about how long you're gone, then will start to know that when the house smells somewhat less of you, then you are probably coming home, and then that's the time to listen for you. So that's my best guess.
From time to time, my sweet little dog will be sound asleep on her mat in the middle of the house, seemingly sound asleep, not even cracking her eyes, and all of a sudden will just wake up barking like crazy. Sometimes she will run to the window in front, but sometimes not. We don't tell her not to bark because that's part of her job, but I have very rarely seen anything that would cause her to bark. Is it something she's smelling or hearing more likely?
Yeah, I mean, it's very potential. There's a real strong potential that she could be smelling something. The dogs certainly smell in sleep. I mean, we smell in sleep, right? This is the power of the smell that's added to natural gas, mercaptan, to make it smell such that we will be aroused from sleep if there's a gas leak, for instance. And we can be aroused from sleep. So imagine the dog who has a much fuller memory of smells that are relevant and interesting, they could be roused from sleep by that. I mean, I don't know if that's always the case with your dog, but it's certainly possible.
But she could be smelling something outside the house and across the street.
Passing by.
Yeah,
because we're all, as we walk by, as dogs walk by, we're leaving our scent behind, right? Like, we literally are. When we all leave, a dog who comes in here, your dog who comes in here would know where you were. Because the seat now smells of you, right, to a dog. I did a little experiment where I wanted to see how, if I could kind of recognize where my dogs had been on the couch. Like, I let my dogs on the couch, of course. It's like, I do that. And they fill up the couch. I have two dogs. And they sit one on either side. And but they switch sides. So I don't know which side they're on. And I thought, I wonder if I could tell which dog had been on which side. So I had my husband, like, note where they were and then call me into the room when the dogs had for some reason gone off to examine something in the other room. And I came in and sniffed the couch on either side. And I could tell. I could tell which was Finnegan and which was Upton. You know, and you know the smell of your dog somewhat as well if you have a dog. I mean, maybe you're not consciously thinking about it, but you do. And I thought, well, that could be a fluke, but I've done it many, many times. They have a different smell, and then once you start attending to it, it's easier to notice whose is whose, and the dog is already noticing all those smells of people, so somebody going by would alert them and arouse them and interest them. Thanks.
How about one more round of applause for Alexander?
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you all so much for coming out. If you could please remember to put up your chair.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.